Greetings all. Thank you for joining me on the Listen to Your Footsteps podcast. I've always been fascinated by why and how people do what they do. This podcast is a way for me to put a spotlight on Africans in art, culture, media, design, and all the spaces in between, and chat to them about their journeys, perspectives, and the like. It's an extension of a book I wrote a few years ago called Listen to Your Footsteps, in which I reflect on my own journey, including fatherhood, identity, and life in general. I try to bring that to every conversation I have. Enjoy. So my guest for today is Bogani Dyer, musician. Is that the best definition?
I guess it depends who you are. Musician kind of encompasses so much, so I think I'm very comfortable with musician as the in a nutshell.
So I'm not a fan of the labels and stuff, but how do you label yourself or categorize yourself if you do it all?
Well, the whole thing about categories, I don't know, sometimes they can be quite limiting, but I think musician is good because it's not too descriptive and it doesn't direct. Because also, you know, you're maybe thinking about who's receiving the information and what is their perception about, you know, if I say to you, jazz pianist, where does that take your mind? Yeah. And does that block some people from experiencing something that might not necessarily fit into the jazz box?
And also they may have a particular perception of jazz. And
if this is the thing.
Like, if I don't like it, I don't like jazz.
Exposed to something that you don't really resonate with.
Yeah.
And then you say, oh, that's jazz. And then you've got a label for something that you don't like. And then I say, hey, I'm a jazz pianist, you know. And I think my story is, you know, a little bit more intricate than that. So to go into very specific labels, you know, it would be a long one. So I think musician is cool. I make music. Yeah.
Did you always want to go into, in essence, the family business?
There was a point in time where that was kind of a big thing, because when I started instrumental lessons, I actually started playing the flute, and that was direct influence from my father, because he's the man on the winds.
Yeah.
So he plays saxophone, he plays flute, a couple of other things as well. But as a direct influence, my first kind of, when I was taking musical lessons, I was like, you know, let me do this. And I guess that was, that's where I can feel the direct influence.
Mm.
But then I think like about a year or two later, that's when I made the like concerted decision to become a musician. And that was based on my own kind of experience at the time.
How old were you?
14.
Was there anything outside of that before that? Did you have we all had, like my daughter was asking me the other day, what did you want to be when you grew up? And I was like, well, there's the pilot and the
those kind
policemen
of things.
And that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But was there anything as clear before being a musician?
Nothing as clear. I can't really recall having that strong feeling about anything else. And it was interesting. I mean, I was listening to a lot of music around that time when I was 14, and it just kind of hit me. And I had this kind of profound realization that music is such a powerful thing. And for me, I just thought, wow, this thing is actually, it's giving me so much that I want to be in this world, and never actually looked back after that.
How did that influence your relationship with your father? I mean, as you were becoming clearer on this, I mean, he's obviously... Was he pushing you to a certain extent or...
Not at all.
Was he very hands-off?
Hands-off.
And also as you were then deciding that this is what I want to do, how were the two of you navigating that? And I ask this because, I mean, it's not music, but I went into business and I worked for my father. But I decided at 15 years old, I wanted to go into kind of the same area. And he then designed my degree. Because he was an academic before he went into, you know, he went into business. And so there was that very direct influence in terms of what I was going to study, the path, you know, the steps I'd take, because I was going into his area.
Yeah, it was different for me. My dad was very hands-off up to a certain point because, you know, you kind of know the young wide-eyed, you know, you can change tomorrow, you can say, you know, with so much passion that I want to do this and then change, you know. So I think my father was protecting himself maybe against like some kind of fleeting desire, or, you know, thing that I was just caught up in a certain period of my life. And he did say to me, I do remember that he said, okay, just know that this is mostly a labor of love and you might not make a lot of money. So just know what you're getting yourself into. He wasn't discouraging, but he was just trying to be like real with me about that. And I think after a while, you know, when he saw that this thing wasn't going away, then he was definitely more supportive, but still not prescriptive in terms of saying, okay, this is what you need to do. He was just guiding the process and helping where he was needed. So when it was time for me to go into deeper study, to study my degree in music, he recommended, he says, okay, well, there's a great jazz program in Cape Town and I know some of the lecturers. I can phone them and find out, you know, what the process is. So yeah, that's, you know, he was chipping in where he was needed,
yeah.
But never did I feel like a heavy hand of like, okay, let's see how we're going to get you ahead now and this, you know, which I've seen in a couple of parents of young musicians. And I always find it like a little bit, I don't know what to think about it. Like my father always had his own life and he was kind of mostly involved in his own project as an artist, you know, and obviously he's a parent as well. And he, you know, he wanted to do right by me and to do good for my future, but you know, never like took his whole life's focus and said, okay, Sonny boy, I'm going to, you know, get you to the finish line. You know, it was never that kind of thing. And I really appreciate that.
I mean, having kids, it's a difficult one.
Yeah.
And I say that because I'm dealing with it right now. It's like trying to figure out how much you help.
Yeah.
How much you push, which doors to open, when to just step back. And I mean, I've had this conversation with, for example, Zubs, who's been in the music industry, but like my son makes beats.
Yeah.
And at some stage finding myself pushing him because I've been around the industry. I understand to a certain extent the ins and outs of it. And then realizing that actually he's just happy to make his beats. And if somebody buys them, great. He's got a little extra pocket money, but he's not already thinking, okay, 20 years down the line, royalties, building a business. And I find it's such a difficult thing as a parent. So, I mean, I definitely commend your father in terms of finding that balance and finding that rhythm.
Yeah, I guess it is a tough one because also you do want to give your child, I mean, I'm not a parent, but I can kind of understand a parent trying to, you know, do something that'll make it easier because it's a loud world. There's so many, you know, there's so many people doing so many things. So
especially now.
If you have some kind of influence or some kind of, you know, like in somewhere to open some kind of doors, you know, I don't blame you for it. It's just, I think when it just becomes, I don't know where it's about drawing the line somewhere. And I guess it's different for
and it's trying to find, person. It's trying to figure out, it's taking the time, I guess, to introspect on where that line is in this particular situation.
Yeah.
And not just kind of going, here's the line, that's it.
Yeah, I'm this not, is the path you're following where it's like also the child now, the person who's actually supposed to be the subject or the creator now has no wiggle room to be themselves because, you know, everything is kind of being scripted, you know.
With your father at least kind of making calls and opening some doors, have you ever felt the pressure of his reputation, his accomplishments?
I've never felt that. Not really. It's always been a thing of like respecting where he comes from and knowing that he comes from a different time. So it's more been a thing about wanting to learn more about that time and the things that are maybe harder for us to access now just because documentation of a lot of our history is just lacking. So, you know, a big part of his story is working with, you know, really amazing legends at a really special time. So when he plays Marabi, it's a different thing to if somebody now is playing Marabi, you know, just has that flavor that you can tell that this is somebody who lived in a particular time. So it's more been a thing about wanting to learn about his experience and his time and, you know, what he went through. And I don't think I've ever had that, like
shadow, real shadow that you're standing underneath.
Yeah. I haven't really felt that so much, which is great.
What does your mother do?
My mother is into IT. So she's like a management consultant. She does a lot of, she's based in Botswana. She does a lot of, like, if government departments are upgrading their systems, computerizing and this kind of thing, or the latest software to help their systems, she does that kind of project management stuff. But now becoming more and more becoming a farmer. So
I'm curious how she has influenced you. I mean, we've talked a bit about your father because in terms of careers and trajectory.
Yeah.
But just in terms, I'm curious with you kind of going that path.
Yeah.
The spaces that your mother allowed you to have and the spaces that your mother created.
Yeah. I mean, my mother's influenced me quite a lot. I think I just feel when I look at how she is and then I kind of, you know, introspect and look at myself, there's quite a lot, I think, that I got from her, you know. And my mother teaches lessons in different ways. Like, she can just say, like, I never move deadlines. I was like, whoa. That one hit me surprisingly. I was like, so she'll stay up till like 3 a.m. in the morning to make sure that her report is done, no matter what, because she had agreed with the client that this thing was going to be in on a particular day. And she honors that no matter what. So, you know, she's someone who's very strict on time.
Yeah.
Even when we're having our wedding celebration in Botswana, it's a celebration. She had told the people it starts at 1 p.m. Like, there were hardly any people at 1, but we started. She's like, no, we're starting now.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe she takes it a little bit too far sometimes, but I just, you know, I kind of appreciate some of those things about her.
I think also working in, let's say, you know, the creative sector and working in music and the arts, one of my personal, it's not a gripe, but sometimes there's a lack of professionalism.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we have a lot of that and it just gets left alone somehow.
And it's like something's supposed to start the few occasions when I like an MC something and they'll say, arrive at such and such a time. And I'll make it a point to arrive at that time. And I have people tell me, but you know, they're going to start late. And I'm like, yes, I know they're going to start late.
Yes.
But I feel like I have fulfilled my side of the obligation.
Of course.
I'm not going to bitch and moan about it.
Yeah.
It's, you're starting when you're starting, but my commitment was this. Let me try and fulfill that commitment.
Yeah, I think we need to just up that just as a society. It's like we can't just take it as a given because those kind of things have knock-on effects, you know. And then, you know, you go to festivals and you're like, okay, things are running like 3 hours late or something, or, you know, all this kind of thing. It's just like a lack of that really making sure that you honor some kind of commitment, you know, because that's actually, for me, it's a sign of respect for everyone who's involved, because you say, okay, arrive at this time, then you arrive at that time, you know. It kind of respects everybody who's involved in the whatever's going on.
How did you navigate identity, particularly when you came to South Africa? So I grew up in Lesotho, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, like me, you're biracial. Mm-hmm. Within a South African context, there's colored, there's... but then even more so, a focus on race, complexion, hair texture, in terms of defining people when they walk. Like when you walk into a space, you'll see people already kind of go, okay, this is where this person fits because of the way they look. Mm. I only came to South Africa when I was 18, 19 years old. And not having grown up with that being a predominant thing, I struggled in the beginning because also at 18, 19 years old, I was trying to figure out myself as a person. And then I enter a space where they're adding, oh, but your complexion is this and your hair texture is that. Therefore, you fit over there.
Yeah, definitely much more complex, I would say, than in Botswana. I was actually saying to someone the other day, it just felt like a much more open society. I mean, I grew up moving between Gaborone and Johannesburg. Mm. So first 7-8 years in Botswana, then South Africa for rest of primary school, then back to Botswana for high school, and then again to Joburg just before I moved to Cape Town to do my degree. And definitely I can say that here, because of the history of this country, I think that it's just a lot more, there's just a lot more stuff going on. And it was definitely an adjustment. And some things I'd look at and even speak to my friends, say, why does this affect you so much? Like, you know, or why are you changing your voice to speak to this person? Like, what? Bro, I know who you are. Like,
yeah.
Be cool, you know? So yeah, there were just these some things that I would see that obviously I was not bound by and didn't have to experience in Botswana. Although there are also complexities in Botswana. I mean, there are these things, but I guess it's just less so because the country didn't go through so much turmoil.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it was definitely a big adjustment to see that and to, okay, you know, get your head around why certain things are the way they are. The interactions between people, why, you know, there's just sometimes friction before, you know,
even before
trying
hello.
To understand what's, you know, which I guess it's a thing about trauma, maybe. It's like, it's people trying to navigate this life where they're kind of bound by so much of the past.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I mean, like my high school in Maseru, the sister school is Maruapula.
Yeah, that's where I went to school.
Is it?
Yeah.
So that was a sister school. I mean, in the what's it? I think it was the late 80s, we actually did a school sports trip to Maruapula.
Okay.
And then also with Waterford and Swaziland.
Yes.
And growing up in those spaces where we weren't just exposed to a different way of looking at the world, but we're exposed to nationalities from all over the space.
Yeah.
And so for me coming here, because I'd never been defined outside of being so-and-so's son, so-and-so's brother, so-and-so's friend.
Yes.
Then coming to South Africa where like all of that has been pushed away and it's just, oh.
Yeah.
The colored guy.
Mm.
And I was like, first of all, I don't know what colored is.
Yeah.
And I identify with my heritage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not my race.
Yeah.
And that was, it took me a while. It took me a while to find myself within that space.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a difficult one and definitely something that I thought about a lot, even in music making and, you know, what is this music saying? Like the music that I create, where does it fit in, you know, identity-wise and, you know, what am I speaking to or what is my heritage or what am I foregrounding? You know, this kind of thing. So it's been like quite a journey in thinking. I mean, still ongoing journey, but I heard this interesting quote by Zim Ngawana. He was in an interview and he said that for him, identity is false. And that kind of stuck with me. I don't think he means it in that way, but I think there are things that go beyond even things like heritage, you know, in terms of who a person is. So that is something that I've been thinking about and saying, okay, you know, even with my own prejudices, like when I meet somebody, I'm going to try as much as possible to have a blank slate and let, you know, our interaction define who this person is, you know? Because, I mean, in the villages in Botswana, there was this, like, I forgot what they were called, but some crazy heavy metal band who dressed. I was like, how did these guys get to that thing? And how do they fit? You know, where would you expect something like that? You know, and they're probably listening to, you know, they're on some other, you know, trajectory. And so to look at them and say things like, oh, you come from this clan, from Botswana. Then you start with the expectations about how somebody should be based on those kind of things, you know. And I think that can somehow be a barrier for a lot of things, for people to freely express themselves how they want to be.
This is the Listen to Your Footsteps podcast, a journey into the life and perspectives of Africans living on their own terms. I also have an email newsletter, a book, and even music playlist available on my site, kojobuffer.com. Let's get back to the conversation. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like when you said, like I'm thinking about it, like our interests, like I mean, I think they're the perfect example because like you're saying, you say this clan, this person's a Motswana.
Yeah.
Already I start having preconceived ideas
about what's about going on.
And then when I hear that, okay, this is like a punk group or they listen to heavy metal, it goes against, therefore it's perceived as abnormal.
Yeah.
Whereas anything can be normal for anyone.
Exactly.
It really is just the, and I'm driving here, I was actually listening to heavy metal. I like to see myself as somebody that explores the breadth of what I'm interested in.
Yeah. Yeah.
But literally what you just pointed out is, despite doing that and not wanting to be perceived a particular way and actually wanting to be engaged on the measure of an interaction, I do it myself.
Yeah.
Without thought.
Yeah. I think we all do.
Mm.
I think there are things that we can't... It's more an active pursuit of your agenda as a person. Like what things you want to change in the world or what you want to dismantle or whatever. So it's an active pursuit of, I guess, unlearning certain things to try and make that kind of difference. But I think it's very tough for us to, I mean, no man is an island, you know, we are part of this kind of, you know, matrix where, you know, we're trying to maneuver, but I think we're all kind of susceptible to that kind of, you know, judgment of situations and things and people.
Shifting slightly. So what's your creative process? So, I mean, how, let's say, you know, song at the end of it, where does it start? And what's that journey from there to there?
there's no stock standard method or procedure. Everything's different. Every song has a different kind of story about how it starts. It could be me practicing. And then from the practicing, I venture off and then I discover something. Or else it can be me in the shower. And then something comes to me, whether it's a rhythm or bass line or melody or something like that. So everything is different. But nowadays, I'd say the most constant thing is that I have my phone with me. Mm. And, you know, thank goodness for technology.
Yeah.
Because you can commit these things like to a recording and, you know, then you can revisit them later. Whereas I think if I didn't have that, it would be much harder to remember all these things. I've got so many like in my phone that are just like, you know, little ideas and things like this. And it's good to go back to that and then just flesh it out and develop it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And yeah, that's pretty much.
How did you decide on album titles and song titles?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I guess because now I'm writing songs with words in them, it makes it much easier for that literary component to frame the meaning of the song. But a lot of my instrumental pieces, it will be something either, you know, what I'm thinking about a lot during that time.
Okay.
Or what I listen to the piece and I'll say, okay, this kind of makes me think of this. Or it can be random, like I have a song called Waiting, and this was just because I'd written the intro and I wanted to try it with it because the intro is like two parts, piano and then a melodic instrument. And I gave it to a friend of mine, Mandisi, on trumpet. So I was like, hey, can you try play this thing with me? And what happens is like it's an interplay. So he plays, or the melody plays, the melody instrument plays the part and then I answer. And then he plays again, you know, that kind of interplay. But he kept on coming in too soon. So I was like, no, wait. And then he said, hey, man, you should call the song Waiting. And then that was it. Nothing too deep or like overly considered about it. So, yeah, it just depends on the situation.
It feels random, but when I used to write poetry, that was always the hardest part for me. What I'd literally do is I'd write all these poems.
Yeah.
And then after the fact, I'd sit there with my notebook and just kind of look at it quickly and just give it a title.
Yeah.
And I mean, now even writing articles and stuff, like I've realized that I'm not very good at headlining.
Yeah.
So I will plonk in a headline.
Yeah.
Knowing that there's an editor somewhere out there who's going to change it and make it better.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, because when you are writing in like creative text, I think like even for me writing songs, like when someone says, what's this song about? Sometimes it's so, you know, and the context is maybe like an interview that you need to kind of have like a nice, you know, frame it nicely in a short little nugget. Sometimes it's really difficult to do that because you can be speaking about so many things at the same time. So sometimes it's I'll say different things about the meaning of the same song. So yeah, it's kind of interesting.
I think it was Seal, the album, I think it was the album with A Kiss from a Rose, where he, you know, because especially then in CDs, they started putting, you know, the shift from just liner notes to actual lyrics.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was one of those guys, like, I'd want to know who produced it, who worked on it. So I'd read through that. And he didn't put lyrics. I think it was him. He didn't put the lyrics. And he put a note saying, it's not for him to say, this is the meaning.
Yeah.
Because we extract meaning from, we extract meaning for ourselves from music.
Yes.
So like my wedding song is an Angie Stone song that is negative.
Yeah.
But purely because I love the bass line on it.
Yeah.
And I think the bass line was sampled from the OJs or one of those groups.
Yeah.
So because I love the bass line, that was around the time I was getting married and became our song.
Yeah.
But the, you know, Angie Stone is singing about her man who's like messing around.
That must have been awkward for your guests.
And people like, but you, and I'm like, the bass line for me, because I'm a sucker for a good bass line. Your song could be mediocre, but if the bass line is good,
it gets you.
I'll probably put it up there.
Yeah. No, I feel you on that one. I think, you know, meanings are different. Even the creator is not the, you know, that's not where the story ends.
Mm.
Because we receive things in so many different ways. So yeah, I totally feel you on that.
I was writing, what's it, Kilinosi?
Kilinosi.
Kilinosi.
Yeah, yeah.
It's such a Kilimong.
So yeah,
that's why I struggle. Yeah, I was struggling to reading it because the Mosotho me is like, no,
It was cool. I mean, it was cool in a way. It was therapeutic because it was at the time. I mean, Kilinosi means by myself.
Yeah.
So it was at that time. I had actually started working on Radio Sachaba, which
is, I saw that. Yeah. Why did you stop on that and then just do something else?
Just because we didn't have people to work with, and that project I had a different vision for.
Okay.
So, you know, being stuck at home, no other musicians, and it just didn't feel natural to continue with the Radio Sachaba project. I thought, hey, why not like try and make some beats or something? Or like, you know, what am I doing here? You know? And yeah, that's how the process. I mean, I already had like some unfinished sketches in my vault of ideas that might never see the light of day. So I had something to start from. But yeah, I was just, you know, just trying to make something that was cool and felt good, and it was, you know, therapeutic, as I say, music making process. And yeah, that's all it was.
How's that translating of that now, kind of when lockdown started to come down and you're performing now? I mean, you created it, was therapeutic, it was in isolation.
Yeah.
But now you're taking it out into the world.
Yeah.
To people, with people.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a great, it actually translated really well into the live thing. But I think in the back of my mind, I was never invested in the project to the level where I wanted to become like, or maybe, let me not speak too soon, but when I was creating it, I didn't have like big ideas of like, okay, this is like a defining moment in my artistic career. But sometimes we also don't have the say in that kind of thing either.
Yeah.
I think it was good for its time. And yeah, it was really great to, you know, finally get to perform with other musicians, share the music and, you know, check the response, which is all really positive. So yeah, it was cool. I mean, obviously different from creating the music, you have to change some things and open up some certain things to make it cool. And, you know, you want the bass player to really sink his teeth and also to have the freedom to, you know, explore and expand and elasticate and, you know, if that's a word, I don't know. You know, it is a word today.
It's allowed.
It's allowed.
We'll create one.
Yeah, to stretch, you know, to stretch things out. So it was fun. It was fun.
So I'm fascinated by that process, like that process of watching musicians give breathing room. And I think, because I was, one of the questions I was going to ask is why jazz?
Yeah.
But I also find that jazz, regardless of how you look at it, at its foundation, from a performance perspective, has seemed a lot more accommodating in terms of allowing each instrument and each musician to breathe.
Yeah.
Whereas like everything else is a lot more structured in terms of like pop and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. It's one of the defining things about it, I guess. It's kind of like a democratic music, you know? It's like everybody gets to have their say, which is special, I mean, in terms of a type of music. And, you know, depending on who's on the bandstand playing the same song, it can sound or come off like completely different, which is the cool thing, because you really get to bring yourself to the fore and express yourself, you know, in the best of situations. I mean, obviously, you know, if you're playing that tuxedo big band jazz and you start like going too, you know, they'll be like, hey, reel it in, buddy, you know. So
I believe that's how Jimi Hendrix ended up in the UK.
Oh, really?
I think he was playing for, it was on the Chitlin circuit in the US, and he was playing guitar for one of the bands.
Mm.
And he just kept on like veering off.
Yeah.
And I think he eventually got fired.
Okay.
He was one of those, like, you know, in the background, you're supposed to.
Yes.
You're supposed to hit the points.
Yeah. Rhythm guitar vibes. Yeah. No, so that's, I mean, you know, that's one of the things that I think is really great about jazz music. Is just that freedom to be who you are.
So I'll go back to why. Flavor. So why jazz as a teenager?
Well,
so I was going to say why jazz.
Yeah,
and going to actually study. So I mean, a lot of people just work through it and practice and become musicians. But you went and you're very clear, and you went and you studied.
Well, it wasn't actually very clear. So the interesting thing is that I'm actually experiencing that now, because I'm doing some teaching at VIDS.
Okay.
And I was accompanying one of the singers. And I was like, yeah, that sounds really good. I was like, are you enjoying this? She's like, no, not really. And then we played the next piece. I was like, oh, that sounded really good. I was like, are you enjoying this? I was like, not really. I was like, are there any songs that you like? She's like, I don't really like jazz. I was like, oh, so why are you studying jazz? She's like, well, I'm actually into electronic music, but I wanted to take music further. And having to explain to parents who are worried about their matric, you know, falling off the rails and this kind of thing. So I actually identify with that to a certain extent, because the music that got me into music was not only jazz. Mm. You know, I was growing up at a time where, you know, Fresh House Flavor One came out and it was at every party and it was the shit. I mean, it was like, that was it. Some of that music I still love to this day.
I mean, the first two Fresh House Flavors are
still... There's some tracks later on, but those ones, I would say the first ones definitely. So what happens is that if you want to take music as a career and you want to study further, you don't have many options. It's not... like maybe today you do, but in South Africa you don't.
Mm.
You can choose between jazz, classical, maybe opera.
Yeah.
Maybe they've got ethnomusicology or something like this, which is more like anthropological musical stuff, you know. But it's not really, like, I know there's some, you know, organizations or entities that offer like DJ classes or this kind of thing, but it's not really... There's not so much of an open music course. So for somebody who's interested, you kind of see, okay, I'm more aligned to the jazzier side of life, and so I'm going to study jazz. So this is true for a lot of people, I think. Mm. But what happens is that when you study the music, you get deeper into it, and then you start to see, okay, you trace back. You know, if you listen to deep house music, a lot of it is actually jazz coming from like R&B, coming from soul music, but you know, where the samples come from. A lot of hip hop, like this was actually interesting, because I did a show with, two shows with Kenny at Untitled Basement, where first was a J Dilla tribute. And we did an interesting take on it, because what we did was we played the songs from which the samples were taken, but the complete songs. And these are all jazz songs. It's like Herbie Hancock.
Kenny's always been brilliant.
Yeah. He used to have that segment. Segment of who sampled and whatever.
Yeah.
And this blew my mind. Because then if you think about it, you're just like, this is actually an interesting way of connecting generations, because these young producers, hip hop producers, were dealing with their parents' record collection, you know, and they just kind of continued the legacy in a different way, but somehow influenced by that, but made it something different with the tools that were at their disposal. So, you know, it's an interesting conversation. I think something in terms of music education to take it forward would be to have more of that kind of open music learning experience where, because what happens now is that jazz as a curriculum has kind of been, you know, boxed into a certain thing where you have to learn jazz history. You know, you start from the early 1900s and then, you know, ragtime and this and this. And these things are becoming more and more, so much more foreign to younger musicians that it's like, how can you even relate to any of that stuff? Like, so it's something that I think about and think, okay, yeah, the whole jazz education thing is quite an interesting thing. But look, for me, I did love some jazz, but it was in and amongst, like, you know, jazz was just part of the thing. It wasn't the only, you know. And then I was also playing piano. So, you know, as a learning thing, it made a lot of sense for me to study jazz and study the greats, be exposed to, you know, that whole world and try analyze what they were doing as a way of improving my facility and knowledge and things like this. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, who are your favorite kind of jazz pianists?
Old school guys. It changes. Look, Art Tatum is like probably the alpha and omega. He was most active in the 1940s, but there's probably no one who's ever been able to play on that level. I mean, even now. I mean, he's ridiculously amazing. You know, Oscar Peterson is amazing. McCoy Tyner, Bill Evans, Ahmad Jamal for a different kind of thing, for his stylistic approach. Herbie Hancock, you know, Begim Seleku, Moses Mulalekwa, but more as like a composer and an artist and a pusher of boundaries. So yeah, there's so many amazing. I see
you didn't include one of my favorite.
Who's that?
Monk.
Oh, Thelonious Monk. You see, that's the thing about, you see, this, you're trying to trap me because...
No, really. I mean, like, everybody talks about, so I grew up where my father had, you know, my father was, he was born in 1935.
Yeah.
In then the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
And in his 20s and 30s, he was in Europe.
Yeah.
So he was collecting a lot of that stuff as it was actually coming out. So that's what I grew up with.
Yeah.
But the spectrum. So from like Peter Tosh and Bob Marley to, you know, Duke Ellington, Count Basie to, I mean, even random things, because I actually have his record collection.
Yeah.
And I was looking at, what's it? It's Roberto Mancini or something. It's like this.
Great composer.
Yeah. But it feels like, you know, cruise music.
Because we wrote a lot for films, I think.
Yeah, because Reader's Digest also used to put out these packs. So my father would buy these packs. So it's like 10 records, jazz of or rock and roll of the 20s.
Yeah.
And I just used to go through all of those things. So also my kind of my favorites are just across such random genres. But I find I connect with, sometimes I connect with the troubled ones for some reason.
Yeah, okay, I'll get to this particular point, but just to go back, when you asked me who my favorite pianist was, you know, which is, I was thinking about piano playing, whereas for me, Thelonious Monk is just like a whole world of music as an artist and a composer. If you had asked me who I think favorite jazz composer, Monk is right up there, like in terms of some of the most well-written swag music, you know, it's just got that thing. So yeah, that's that thing. And then you said the most troubled ones. You know, art is an interesting thing. I mean, sometimes the best art comes from, you know, the depths of, you know, the worst experiences. And, you know, when you have an outlet to express yourself, you know, sometimes the most hard-hitting art comes from that place. So I can totally understand that.
This is the Listen to Your Footsteps podcast, a journey into the life and perspectives of Africans living on their own terms. I also have an email newsletter, a book, and even music playlist available on my site, kojobuffer.com. Let's get back to the conversation. So one of the hardest things for me to learn how to do was write poetry happy.
Okay.
So I spent a lot of, I mean, exactly what you're talking about. So I spent a lot of time kind of in dark places.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing.
Intentionally.
Nothing dramatic. No, not intentionally, just kind of life. And I generally wrote when I was feeling down.
Yeah.
And then, you know, kind of did the work on myself.
Mm.
And was actually fearful at some stage that if I lost that,
yeah,
would I still be able to write? Yeah.
Would you still have the juice?
And then just in general, like some of the writers that I've followed and that I've liked and have lived eventful or dramatic or traumatic lives.
Mm.
And I've spent my life just trying to be better, right?
Yeah.
And be better for myself, be better for my family, be better for people around me. So, you know, to live a lot lighter.
Yeah.
To be a lot lighter.
Yeah.
And I had moments where I'm like, does that mean that I am going to sacrifice any potential greatness I may have as a writer?
Mm.
Because I am sorting myself out.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, my first impression on that is just that, I don't know. It's like, I think maybe like what hits hard is sometimes the most like sensationalist thing, you know? So, you know, sometimes if you are, you know, you're living lighter, you're cool, you're going to gym, you're doing your things, you know, you're getting your hours of sleep in, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe you're not going to say the most heart-wrenching things, but I think somehow there is some depth that you can achieve by having gone through moments of darkness, coming out the other side. And even though you're not there anymore, there's perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a way to look at something while you're in it and when you're looking hindsight,
back, yeah,
you know,
looking back at it.
So, yeah, I don't know, man. We're going through this journey of life, and you live and you learn every day, and you know review the process and check. But I hear what you're saying.
I was thinking about this the other day. I was listening to Radio Sachaba.
Yeah,
and just kind of looking at the industry, and I try to read up on, particularly from the business side, kind of what's going on, media, music, that sort of stuff, and kind of looking at it and going, well, for you as a musician, we all also want to be able to eat, right? And live. And everybody likes nice things to a certain extent. And just because you've chosen a particular area doesn't mean you shouldn't enjoy nice things.
Yeah.
But with, for example, the album with the minimal amount streaming pays, us coming out of a lockdown where all of a sudden a lot of musicians who were able to sustain themselves quite well off live performance, all of a sudden live performance is gone.
Mm.
Why release new albums? And how do you see kind of your things panning out in terms of the projects that you'll be involved with in future?
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, you know, this is a deeply personal project for me, Radio Sachaba. And, you know, while I was making the album, I was also completing my master's degree, which I got last year. And my thesis for my master's was entitled, I can't remember the exact title, but it's to investigate whether young jazz composers are using their art to address social issues. So I was kind of inspired by the quote. Well, my departure point was hearing Nina Simone say that an artist's duty is to reflect the times, you know? So that kind of stuck with me, and I thought, okay, in my own process, am I doing enough to speak to? Because, you know, if you look around, we got a lot of stuff that's going on, you know? So am I just making music just to satisfy, to say, okay, I play great and I make, you know, I can write music and whatever? Is that, how does that, you know, touch on what's going on around me, you know? And for me, it's kind of important, I think, as somebody who can see. I think most people can see, but it was just important for me to interrogate that side of things. So I think that the music was being informed by the research, and I did some interviews with some other younger, my contemporaries, and you know, seeing where they were at in this conversation and how they feel about it, and then also doing some readings around, you know, South Africa, and also the history, and looking at how music was a part of the liberation struggle as well. So that really enriched my outlook, and I feel like I said a lot of things that meant a lot to me on the album. So I wasn't necessarily thinking about it as an industry thing, you know.
Yeah,
I was thinking, I mean, because the album was also recorded over like 4 years or something, you know, I went through different kind of configurations of band and different people. And it was only after I recorded the one song that I said, this is the sound that I want. And then I recorded quite a lot of the extra stuff to match with that sound. Because for a while now, I've been looking for kind of more kind of groove-based Afrobeat type of, you know, palette to work with.
Yeah.
So when we play live, that's the formation that I'm using. And then thematically, the messaging is kind of, you know, looking at society and you know, looking at myself. And, you know, I think a lot of people are dealing with really personal things.
Yeah.
So I speak about that as well in the project. So, yeah, I wasn't thinking about it like, okay, why release album streaming numbers? This. I hope that, you know, the music touches people. It's, you know, it's an interesting thing. Like sometimes you can just release and then, you know, the music will touch different people. And I've been checking, like, the people who've been responding to the music are actually such a diverse, you know, age range, country, and, you know, lots of learned people saying very nice things to me. I'm like, wow, okay, damn, okay. You know, so it's been interesting the kind of traction, like in terms of what kind of people are resonating with it. And I can't even say it's this type of person, you know. So
I mean, what I find, what resonates with me, I mean, I've done a couple of listens. I haven't listened intensely, but, you know, because I'm always playing music.
Yeah.
Is that, let's call it the uncategorization of it. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so, you know, you co-founded Electronic Group years ago, and in your wheelhouse, like you said, you grew up influenced by different types of music.
Mm.
Whereas some of your earlier stuff felt very jazzy. And I mean, you're Standard Bank, you know, young jazz artists. It was very specific. Whereas this feels a lot more the other dimensions of you in terms of sound.
Yeah.
And I find that, I mean, for example, I'm a huge Robert Glasper fan. And that whole group, like Kamasi Washington, etc., where they've just broken out of, you know, they've broken out of the, this is a category.
Yeah.
So it is jazz, but it's jazz today, as opposed to we're going to hark back to to another time.
Yeah, I think it was very deliberate. And now that I'm a few albums in and a little bit older, I kind of have the balls to do it, because I'm like, you know, what's the, cause the thing is, you know, we are constricted, like sometimes not even consciously so, you know. So I remember when I was awarded this Standard Bank Young Artist Award, I had to think like, okay, you know, cause what usually happens is like you record an album and it gets funded and all this kind of thing. But I was thinking, so what music am I going to put on this thing? You know, and it's kind of, I felt this kind of thing of like, I have to, you know, I have to extend the story, like South African jazz. I need to try and write something in a chapter of the book of South African jazz. Whereas now I'm just like, listen, I'm going to do what I like, you know. And interestingly enough, that doing what I like thing, if I interrogate that, I can see all the all the points of things that I'm interested in. And that can actually tell a much more interesting story than trying to say that, okay, write a South African jazz album.
Yeah.
You know, so this is kind of how my, I guess, I've developed from that point. So I think Radio Sechaba is definitely the best indicator of a lot of different things that I'm interested in and being okay with that. Because also, there's also the thing of thinking like, shit, am I writing like five different albums and trying to put them in one thing? You know, because there are some jazzier tracks in this album. But then I was like, hey, whatever, man. Like, you know, when I'm making a playlist at home, sometimes I'll put like one jazz track, one this, one this one. So, and I think people are quite like the standard person now is actually the eclectic one, like in terms of, you know, musical tastes and things that they can respond to. So it's also been a learning thing of like saying, okay, I need to put a body of work together, but cohesive is not what it used to mean in terms of saying, okay, I'm going to put, you know, I'm going to put this thing and it must be like this. But it's different things for different projects, you know. For this one, I felt it was fitting, but then, you know, when I do eventually do another trio album, there's something about just having three people in the room and then we're going to just explore that. And it just is always going to be that sound of the three people. But what goes deeper in that one is that we've known each other and played together for like 6 or 7 years now. So the interplay is really great. You know, those kind of unscripted moments that just...
So the conversations happen via the music as opposed to the conversation.
Yeah. So it's different things. But yeah, definitely for this one, I felt like I wasn't going to like hold back in terms of trying to restrict or, you know, yeah.
So what do you do outside of music?
What do I do?
What do you occupy your time with?
I read. I listen to music. Okay, I read.
So what do you read? I mean, what you enjoy? What are your last two reads? So I'm always reading like 2-3 books at the same time.
Yeah. This is a problem. I thought it was a problem.
No, it's not. It's not.
Getting validation from you, man. from a writer.
So I mean, I read as a reader. Because I've been asked. I've been asked when I read.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, when I'm reading, I'm a reader. I read because I love reading books.
Same for me in music as well. Yeah. Because some people are like, oh, doesn't it bother you to listen to music? And you're like analytical mode, but it's actually not like that.
Mm.
I've been reading A Bewitched Crossroad. It's by Bessie Head, I think. I think it's a factual book. It's about the history of Botswana and the different clans and the Kalanga people. My mother's Kalanga. So it kind of focuses on the people from Sibino, northern part of Botswana. So I've been reading that. I've been reading a marketing book by Seth Godin.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a Seth Godin fan.
Yeah, I dig him. I think he's cool. Which one is it? Permission Marketing.
Permission Marketing, yeah.
Yeah, so I've been reading that. And then what else? Yeah, there's a couple that I've kind of started and then didn't really go forward. But I think those ones are the ones that I'm like, you know.
Can you put down a book? Can you stop reading a book?
Yeah.
Because it's recommended. So a lot of people a lot of people say if it's not working for you, put it down.
Yeah.
I can't not finish a book.
Oh, really?
It can be painful. It can run for like 2 years.
Oh,
but
amazing.
Eventually I work my way through it.
Oh, and Long Walk to Freedom. I'm also reading that, yeah. Yeah.
Such useful books.
I just thought like Long Walk to Freedom. I've never really known this guy's story. Like, and it's been really interesting to delve into that. Like, you know, the language is super weird though. I was just like, you know, the word comeuppance. It's like, I'm just like, bro, what? How do you talk? Like... It feels like he was trying to finesse the thing, but yeah, it's really interesting to go through that story.
What do you listen to, like when you're just chilling?
Oh, depends on the mood, depends on the vibe. When I was on my way here, I was listening to Walter Smith, amazing saxophone player in the States, New York, like, you know, the Cats.
Yeah.
But then I've also been listening in the past few weeks a lot to classical music.
Okay.
Somehow, after being in New York, we were in New York for a month with my father recently. We came back on the 10th of May, 3 weeks ago. And after the craziness of New York, I think I just like wanted to feel some order, like some. And sometimes classical music is quite amazing. I don't think I've appreciated classical music as much as I have in these past few weeks. I always used to say, ah, so rigid and so. But there's actually something amazing about like a composer, a great composer who's created this piece of art and then a good interpretation of that composition. So even though you know what's coming in terms of the melody and the whatevers, there's something there. And I did play a bit of classical music while I was studying, and I want to continue, like, you know, there's some really great music there.
So I've been reading Japanese writer Haruki Murakami.
I've been meaning to, getting to him.
I've been meaning to get into him, so I got into him early last year.
Okay.
And I started off with his short stories.
Okay.
And this year, I just finished my third of his novels.
Yeah.
Because I was worried that what I liked in the short story wouldn't translate to the novel.
Mm.
Because I feel like he has a certain pace.
Mm.
And it's not too up there. It's steady,
mm-hmm.
which is what I enjoy about his writing.
Mm-hmm.
And years ago, I came across a Spotify playlist. So there was an article done on his record collection or vinyl collection this day and age in his office. And I think it's like over 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody went and tried to create a playlist of the music in his collection. I mean, this playlist runs days.
Mm-hmm.
But so I've been playing that a bit more, but I just finished a book of his. In the book, classical, but in particular opera, keeps cropping up.
Mm.
And there was like one particular album. I can't remember the name of the composer. So literally halfway through the book, I was like, actually, while I'm reading the book, because the characters they'll sit in the lounge and then they'll put this record on.
Mm.
I'm like, let me play it. So I've been listening to a lot of that. And then there's because I have an email newsletter and I came across a video of, I think it's the cellist of Kosovo or during the Serbian war.
Mm-hmm.
And this cellist goes out and plays, I can't remember what he plays, but literally in ruins. He plays this piece and doesn't get shot. Like the snipers, it's broken down area. So I found a version of it and I played that. And because I use, you know, streaming services, I like to, you know, I go to radio based on a song.
Mm.
So I've also been in the last 2-3 weeks submerged a bit more. I mean, I change every day. So I'll go from hardcore reggae in the morning to hip hop at lunchtime to soul music at 5.
Mm.
But I've been doing a lot more classical.
Yeah.
And there's something calming about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Depending on what you find.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. And sometimes that's what you need.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, man.
Kojo, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I must get a copy of Radio Sachava on vinyl. I saw you unboxing.
Yes.
And I was like, I must actually send you a message for me to get one.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
We'll make a plan.
Nice one. Thanks, brother.
Thank you for listening to the Listen to Your Footsteps podcast. I'd appreciate it if you could subscribe and or leave a comment wherever it is you're listening. To access the book, there are links on the website www.kojobuffer.com. If you're interested, there's also a curated email newsletter that I put out fortnightly to monthly. You can subscribe at zebraculture.substack.com. I hope you enjoyed listening and walk away with something that makes your world a little bit easier.